Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Gas mark 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm gonna cook a meal that's gonna make you mine. We're turning up the oven, now we're ready to roast. When you touch behind it, you'll love it the most. Come on and put me in your loving shoe.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is David Nolan. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you very much.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Now, I'm taking off one of the cover of one of your books, The King of Manc Noir, and until I'd heard you talking on the Old Brother podcast, I wasn't even aware there was a thing called Manc Noir.
Well, that's the beautiful thing, you see, because if you make up a genre, you automatically become the king of it. So I can recommend that to all your listeners. Make up something like, you know, handbag noir or something like that, or anything you fancy. And then because you've made it up, you automatically become the king of it. It's the rules. I don't make the rules. I just stick to them.
Indeed, indeed. Well, look, that is a trilogy of books. It's Black Moss from 2018, The Mermaid's Pool from 2020, and last year, The Ballad of Hanging Lees, which the first of the books introduces us to Danny Johnson and flits between the Strangeways riots of 1990 and 2016. And one of the characters within that story is D.I. John Smithdown, who becomes the star of your second book, Mermaid's Pool. And then for your third one, you return us to Danny Johnson and vigilantes who are trapping sexual predators. Being from Manchester, as I am with my Liverpool influence, but generally speaking, I grew up in North Manchester and Prestwich, those kind of areas. And my mother's side of family are like Middleton way. So reading about, you know, going towards the border between Lancashire and Yorkshire in your stories, I love that localized ideas, and because I can picture them as well. It's a rare thing, certainly with noir fiction, for me to feel like I know where you're walking, I know where you're going. It sounds like a daft question for someone from that area, but what made you focus so much on sort of that like kind of localized detail?
It's always kind of bugged me with Manchester, and by Manchester I'm meaning Greater Manchester.
Yeah.
Is that you tend to get two Manchesters. You get the Salford, shameless kind of Greater Manchester.
Yeah.
And then you get the city centre, gay village, Didsbury kind of Manchester. And you don't see the other aspects of Manchester represented. Mm. You just don't see it ever. So that really bugged me. So, because it's a, you know, Greater Manchester is an incredibly diverse place, and you just never see it represented. It's always like that kind of that horrible shameless kind of caricature, or it's this kind of people swanning around Didsbury and wine bars kind of thing. And there's so much more to it than that. So the great thing about somewhere like Oldham is that it's very diverse, and it's got the hills right on the doorstep, and it's the hills. For me, always, again, it bugs me. This will be a recurring theme, actually, things that annoy me. But it annoys me when people go, oh, have you seen that? Oh, have you seen that Scandinavian noir on BBC Four? Oh, it's so bleak. Oh, it's so foreboding. Let me take you up on the hills above Oldham. And there I'll show you a bleak landscape, not a tree as far as you can see. If you get lost up on those hills, if you broke a leg up there, you'd be in the weird position of you'd probably die, but you can see the Arndale Centre in the centre of Manchester. best. So it's this incredibly bleak, foreboding landscape in spades, which is brilliant. And also, it's got loads of reservoirs. And one of my obsessions, one of my many obsessions, is reservoirs. I love reservoirs, which is why all three books are named after bodies of water.
Yeah.
Because I love them. And the bleaker, I don't like these reservoirs with like ice cream vans and benches near them. I like reservoirs that are grey slabs of water in the middle of nowhere.
So where their function is that's all they are. They're not really for sightseeing.
Well, that's the beautiful thing is that the company who runs the reservoir, it has the most utilitarian name in the world, which is United Utilities. And that's what they are for. They are for the storage of water and obviously for dumping dead bodies next to, you know, that's it. They have no other function.
Now, part of your background before, I mean, maybe as alongside your writing, you worked in TV. You produced TV, you produced TV documentaries. And for you to then have a character who is a radio journalist during, I guess, what would have been a busy news time, the Strange Ways riots and everything else going on in Black Moss, then how much of that was you sort of using your, were you relying on your memories of it, or did that end up being a lot of research for you?
I love doing research, but the one thing that I didn't have to research was the Strange Ways riot.
Okay.
Before I worked in television, I worked in radio. And I was a reporter for a station that was called Piccadilly Radio.
I remember it
which
well.
Which at the time was like the biggest station outside of London. It was a big deal to work at Piccadilly. And I was a reporter. So I was that reporter standing outside Strange Ways for 3.5 weeks during the riot. So I didn't have to do any research for that at all. So that whole carnival vibe in the middle of the night at Strange Ways with people selling T-shirts and selling weed and selling beer and all the mad stuff that would happen around the jail at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, I was there. So zero research required.
I passed it every day. That was my Qantas surveying years, as I call it. I was like a trainee Qantas surveyor from the age of 16 to 19.
Rock before. And roll.
Exactly. But we used to come in from Radcliffe. You come down the old road and pass Strange Ways every day before we'd park up in the railway arches on the Salford side of the river and then walk up into Deansgate. So yeah, every day we saw it. So it was weird to then have all those memories sort of rekindled, because I hadn't thought of the consequence of this being the hottest ticket in town, and therefore all of the news and crime didn't matter almost. I'd never even give that a thought. And I thought it was a wonderful aspect to your book.
And I pinched it because somebody once told me that there was one murder during 9/11. Someone saw the planes going into the buildings and thought, I know what, I'll kill somebody and I'll get away with it.
No.
And it's never been solved. So when I was kind of, all this was formulating in my mind, I thought, well, I don't know a great deal about 9/11. I'm certainly no expert. But what could be the Mancunian equivalent of something that was really big that would distract everybody? And that was Strange Ways Riot. I don't remember doing another story for the 3.5 weeks of the riot. And in fact, pretty much afterwards for a week or two as well. So you think, well, what was all this other stuff going on that we didn't cover? Because basically our listening figures went through the roof. The management were all delighted and rubbing their hands, because in commercial radio, that means more money.
You can
charge more for the adverts. And therefore, all this other stuff that probably was incredibly important effectively got ignored because everybody was looking in another direction. And I thought, well, actually, that misdirection is a great way of a great plot device, I suppose, for, well, why would nobody care about a kid being killed? Well, it's because all the police and all the journalists were all looking for a promotion, me included, during the Strange Ways riot.
It's a trilogy now in 2023, and obviously the third one was published in 2022. Was it always a trilogy, or has this evolved as you've written each book?
Right. It was. I didn't even think I'd finish the first book.
Oh, blimey.
I didn't think I would get across it. Right. I'll tell you how it happened. I hope this doesn't sort of put a handbrake on your show, but you know, this is how it happened. I was a music writer. I'd written lots and lots of music books. And I was very good at it. and you can look them all up if you like, loads of them. A very professional music writer. And then a teacher from my old school was arrested and charged with sex offences against boys at the school going back across 20 years from the 70s into the early 90s. Mm. And those boys included me.
Oh, wow.
And I gave evidence and was waiting for my court date and all the rest of it. And I thought, you know what? I could do more here. So I jacked in all my work and sat and watched the trial. And I wrote a book about it. I made a documentary for Radio 4 about it. And I made a documentary for ITV about it. And I was inundated by people telling me their stories. I still get it now. Years later, I still get about 3 a month of boys, lads, from the 70s and 80s, telling me their stories. It's my part-time job. And then I was going to write a big book about historic abuse in this country in the 2010s, when this country went mad for historic abuse. And I got a commission to write a book, a big book, started doing interviews, and then the publishers came back and said, you know that book you're writing about historic abuse and government and power and celebrity and money and all this? We don't want you to write it. In fact, here's some money to bugger off.
Wow.
And I was quite upset. It's called, in publishing circles, it's called a kill payment.
Yeah.
I was given a kill payment to basically go away.
Yeah.
And I was so angry and so annoyed and so upset because it just felt like the 70s all over again, trying to shut us up.
Yeah.
Trying to silence us, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was so frustrated that I just started, this is not going to translate well on a podcast. I started doing this, bang, 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 with my fingers on a keyboard.
Yeah.
Because I was so angry. And I didn't tell anybody what I was doing. I didn't even tell my wife what I was doing. And eventually I showed it to her what I was doing. And she said, why are you writing a crime fiction book? I said, I don't know. Is that what it is? I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going bang, 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 and something is coming out. And word for word, what I had written was the first chapter of Black Moth. Word for word.
Amazing.
And I just thought, right, well, I'll carry on because it seems to be helping me process my anger. And I carried on and I gave up a couple of times. And I kept going. And I tell you who kept me going, actually, is David Keenan. David Keenan is the author of This Is Memorial Device. And he told me that he'd done his job in an off-license. And for for 10 years, he went home every night and wrote and never showed anybody. And I thought, well, if he can keep going for 10 years, I can keep going as well.
Yeah.
So I kept going. I finished it. And then I was happy with that. And then I typed the words crime fiction publisher into the internet. And I sent it off to the first name that came up. I sent it to them. And they said, we'd like to publish your book. There you go.
That's amazing. I mean, obviously, where the roots are is tragic, but that idea of where you, from a writing a book point of view, that was amazing.
But what I realised was that all the things that I was going to write about in the factual book, which was going to be called Abuse of Power, great title, I'd actually written about them, but they're all in there in Black Moss. Everything that I was going to talk about, particularly the way that missing children are treated, depending on their social status in this country.
Yeah.
You know, how many missing children can you name apart from Madeleine McCann?
Yeah.
That's a disgrace, isn't it? A disgrace.
Yeah, I mean, in between when we made contact and now we're talking now, I tweeted at you, didn't I, that the story of the 200 migrant refugees who've gone missing and they don't know where they are and they're all children. They're like, they don't care.
Absolutely. Nobody cares. The lower you are on the scale, the less chance you have a being found if you're missing. Mm. Nobody cares. So all of that stuff that I was going to write about, I did write about it. It's all in Black Moss, but it's all, you know, kind of coated in this guise of crime fiction.
I mean, that was the bit that stood out when you were talking to the Hanley brothers, is that idea that you can write about stuff in fiction that, as you said with your kill feed, that you're not allowed to write about as a piece of fact.
Yeah, lawyers can't touch you. It's great. And it is remarkably close. And I think you noted there's a character in the book who's an MP, a flamboyant MP, called Peter Jeffries. And the older heads will realise that that is Geoffrey Dickens, the former MP for Saddleworth. It's him. Mm. I've just changed his name around a little bit. And I've done that a lot. Everybody in the book is a real person. I'm not clever enough to make stuff up, so I don't bother. So everything in the book has happened in one form or another, and every person in the book is based on a real person.
So in that sense, if that's where the energy and the drive came for the first one, where at what stage did you think, hold on a minute, I've got these characters now that I've breathed life into. There's more stories to tell.
I thought, it was less that. It was more, was that a fluke? Because I've had extraordinary luck through my career. I really have. I mean, I am the jammiest person you'll ever come across, really. And I thought, was that a fluke? I couldn't even remember, to be honest with you. I can't even remember writing it because it all kind of spat out, you know, in a fury. So I thought, well, how did I do it? Could I do it again just to see if it was a fluke or not? And that's why I wrote it. I didn't write it for any other reason other than I wanted to see if it was a fluke or not and whether I could do it again.
Just pause there for a second. That is quite amazing for the body of work you've got behind you. You know, books about George Michael, books about the Sex Pistols and, TV programs, documentaries. The idea that even with that long tail behind you, having done this piece of work, the start of something new was still kind of a foreboding, still was like, can I do this? That's quite amazing.
Well, that's how I felt. I mean, to be honest with you, I've always felt like that. Every single thing I've ever done, and I've made hundreds of documentaries. It's the music ones that people tend to know about, loads of other stuff as well. And every time I always kind of think, the night before I start something, I kind of think, and I even did it with Black Moss. I remember lying in bed the night before thinking, I'll ring up the publisher and I'll say, right, it's been a mistake, just pulp them. Right, just get rid of them, and I'll pay, for the costs, and let's just forget about it. I can literally remember lying in bed the night before thinking, no, let's just ask them to say thank you very much for the opportunity, but let's just sack it off. Yeah. And I think that's a good thing. Anybody who kind of cuts about thinking they're the bollocks, I'm very, very suspicious of people like that.
Yeah, no, I remember watching a BAFTA lecture with Scott Frank, who's won Oscars and all kinds. And he talked about the fear of the blinking cursor at the start of a new project always. He said, it's like I've never written before.
Yeah, and that's good. I think that's a good thing. And you're not going into kind of, muscle memory and going through the motions. So the second time around, I thought, right, okay, well, how did I do it? How did I write a book? How did I write a novel? And I thought, right, I did it because I was angry. I was angry about something. And that's what spurred me on. So I literally sat down and I made a list of things I was angry about. So I was angry that Tommy Robinson was standing to represent me in Stockport, the former leader of the English Defence League. Mm. I was angry about the murder of Joe Cox, assassinated on the streets of Britain, shot in the head because by a far-right nutcase. I was angry about the moors around Manchester were all on fire. I was really angry about it. Right, I was furious about it. Yeah. And I was even angry. My wife had breast cancer. And I was really, really angry about that. I was furious about it. I can remember sitting in the Christie Hospital in Manchester and sitting in the reception. I hated sitting in the reception. And thinking, I'll go and see one of the members of staff. And I'll ask them, can they take it out of her and give it to me? That's how angry I was. And in fact, that very thought, that very line, one of the characters in Mermaid's Pool says it. Will he take it out of her and give it to me? Because that's how angry I was about it. So that's what I did. So Mermaid's Pool is about, it's not the lead character. The lead character is a family. It's mum, who's a policeman. It's dad, who's a policeman. It's mum, who has cancer.
That's right.
It's the daughter, who has who's a journalism student. And all of that stuff, I did a book talk recently. I love doing book talks. I do a lot of book talks. And I was in Ramsbottom, I think, and a guy came up to me and said, all that cancer stuff that was in Mermaid's Pool was spot on, absolutely spot on. Mm. And I should know, I'm an oncologist. And that was like a round of applause.
Oh, my goodness. That is not quite a mirror of it. But I, over lockdown, my mother went into hospital and I couldn't see her because I was in London. She was in Manchester. And it was for a blood transfusion. And while she was there, they decided to start chemo on her for a leukemia they'd been monitoring. And that, what you describe of like putting the energy into how you feel about that emotion, I'd ended up writing a character that was my mother, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm baffled by these people who claim to make everything up. You must be a mug. Why on earth would you want to make characters up and people up and situations up? You know, just take them from real life and change the names around a bit. You know, it's, you know, that's where it is, and that spurs you on. If you're angry about it. You know, a great man once said, "Anger is an energy."
He did indeed,
and it really is. You know, and it's you know, some people, you know, light candles and play whale music and that helps them write and this kind of stuff. I just get angry about stuff and that helps me.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely got the Tommy Robinson reference. you know, it's like I was thinking, oh my God, that is him. It was like, it took about three times around when the name comes up and I was like, no, he is, isn't it? That's what he's doing.
Yeah. And, you know, again, based, it's about, you know, far right trying to take over the council in Oldham by provoking racial tension. And that's exactly what happened in Oldham in the early 2000s.
Again,
and at the back of each book there's a little couple of pages basically saying, look, this is real. You know, I know it's a crime fiction book, but it's based on a real problem or a real situation. You know, so I am unashamedly and unembarrassedly a table banger. That's what the books are there for. They're not because I like seeing my name on the side of a book. Mm. They're there because I'm furious about something and I want to bang a table about it.
So in that sense then, so I guess what was the anger that then fueled the Ballad of Hanging Leaves? Because you bring us back after focusing our attention on Detective Inspector John Smith down, who was part of Danny Johnson's story in Black Moss, then you return us back to Danny Johnson for your third book.
Yeah, I couldn't work out really what he would be doing in the modern age. Mm. And then that's why Mermaid's Pool is set like in 1988.
Yeah.
As rave is kicking in and ecstasy is kicking in and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And also it meant that I could flesh out the characters more who were slightly to the side of the action in Black Moss. And then I twigged what he would be doing. A friend of mine runs an operation called Altrincham Today, which is a micro news site, a very specialist, you know, just covers a very specific area news site. And he, my friend, is David Pryor, and he's the videographer, the news editor, the lead reporter, the photographer. He does everything himself on a mobile phone. And I thought, that's what Danny would be doing. He'd be doing that because he's such an idiot and he can't get along with people very well that, you know, nobody would employ him. So he creates a job for himself. So I was able to work that out. And then, yeah, what was I angry about? I was angry about my own profession, where there's no local accountability anymore and journalists are threatened with the sack unless they get above a certain amount of clicks for their stories.
Mm.
So what kind of stories are they going to write? Are they going to write stories about missing kids that nobody cares about, or are they going to write clickbait about Piers Morgan? There you go. So I was really angry about that.
Yeah.
And I was also really angry that the online grooming during lockdown and after had gone up 75%. That's just stuff we know about. Online grooming, massive increase.
That's shocking.
During and after lockdown. One of the terrible, terrible byproducts of lockdown. So I was really angry about that. So I said, right, okay, let's have online grooming. Let's have, you know, this debate about the, you know, the state of journalism. And also let's what's the most kind of provocative thing I could do in terms of victims? Okay, let's make the victims paedophiles. Hey, that'll be good. Let's make the victims paedophiles and let's test your liberal sensibilities. by doing that. So it was a real kind of poke in the chest kind of thing.
So when you're writing with that kind of energy, that's sort of like you say, you're banging away on your typewriter or your keyboard, as it were. What, thinking of the Ballad of Hanging Lees, what do you remember, and especially where you're melding sort of your ideas of fiction with where you're taking stories from fact? And obviously the thing about fiction over real life is it kind of has to make sense and or be dramatic. I mean, I know it's one of the problems, certainly I know I fight with when I'm trying to write screenplays, is that, you know, you, real life doesn't make sense, whereas obviously stories tend to make sense in the way that we read them. So for you, what was the storytelling challenges bringing the Ballad of Hanging Lees to life?
Well, it was, one, you have to write a standalone book that works on its own.
Okay.
And then secondly, you have to do, you know, a certain amount of exposition work in order to fill in the stuff from the other books without, so you're not alienating anybody. And then you have to, you know, I wanted it to be a trilogy, so I wanted to tie it up. I wanted, you know, I didn't want anyone thinking, ooh, you know, what was all that about? Apart from one thing, and I've literally never actually said this out loud, but in the third book, there is an ever so slight whiff, not even a whiff, a tiny whiff of the almost supernatural. If you've not noticed it, if you've read the book, that's perfect, because I wanted it to be that kind of whiff of, because there's almost a suggestion that Danny is being guided by the shirtless boy, this boy who's been missing, who was dumped by the side of Black Moss, and that everything, he's been guided by this dead child. But it's very, very low key, and I used to love those shows like Armchair Theatre and Thriller and things like that from ITV back in the 70s, of like, you'd have a story that just had one element, which was like, what was that? What was that all about? That was like, how do you explain that? And I love those kind of things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The real book, uncanny, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. You know, Tales of the Unexpected.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, just that little whiff of, what the hell was that? How? Yeah, that's explained. That explained. But how could that have happened? It's almost that little tiny whiff of that his hand has been guided all the time by this little boy that he's found by the side of Blank Moss in the first book. And I was a bit scared of doing that, but I just thought, well, it's the third book, why not? You know, let's go.
No, indeed.
So there is just that little element.
I'll look out for that, because I've read the first two and I read them back to back, and then I thought, I can't just do them all, because I got them all three of them for Christmas this end of the year last year. So I was like, I devoured the first two and I thought, I've got to save it. I've got to wait for. So I'm just about to finish the second book in between, and I'm going to go back to it. So I'll have that in mind when I go in. Before we get on to the films, one question.
Oh, yeah, film. Sorry, I forgot about that. Yeah.
I appreciate your candor, really, about, because I think the whole writing process is something. I mean,
it's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Then I've had to learn as from my point of view. And I love hearing how other people tackle it and what are the challenges. I think, fiction has its own demands, but also you're coming from a point of view which is very different from my point of view, which is very different from someone else's point of view. So how you solve those problems is as personal as well.
The thing I've got by advantage is decades of being a journalist.
Yeah.
Which is, this story is for the 12 o'clock news. That's not negotiable. You don't, do you know what I mean? You can't go to the news editor and say, oh, do you know what? I'm not really feeling this story at the moment. I think maybe if I could light some candles and maybe just have a little think. No, it don't work like that. the story is for the 12 o'clock news. So there's no, I've always taken a very workmanlike approach to it. You know, my dad worked on building sites and he never said to the foreman, I'm not really feeling this. This bricklaying or this glazing today, I'm not really in the zone. No, he shut up and got on with it. And I take the same view, shut up and get on with it.
I'm with you completely. I've the amount of arguments I've had about what writer's block is and what writer's block isn't. And often I say, look, you can't be arsed, just admit it.
Yeah. And I tell you what I hate more than anything else is on Twitter is, hashtag I'm writing. Hashtag I'm writing. No, you're not. You're hashtag dicking about on Twitter.
Indeed you are. Now, before we get on to the films, there is a question. I've interviewed a lot of documentarians on the podcast, and a favourite question I like to ask, and I know you talked about it a lot on the Old Brother podcast, but when you're doing a documentary, in my mind, there's this idea of what you perceive you're going to cover and then what you learn by doing the documentary. So with something where, with I Swear I Was There, the one about the infamous Sex Pistols gig in 76, which you've obviously written a book about that then became, did the TV documentary that then became a book. Thinking about what you perceived about that gig, what's been like the biggest surprise or biggest lesson you learned from doing the documentary and the book? What did you uncover that you could never imagine going into it?
Right. I mean, this has now become like common parlance, but when we did the documentary and done the book, we couldn't type this into the internet. We had to do this old school style and track everybody down and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And the weird thing was, I told you before that I'm the luckiest person going. I got my first book deal because I was making this documentary. I was dragged into an office at Granada Television where I worked, and they said, tell these guys that story about the Sex Pistols. So, I told them the story because I'd always wanted to make this program. And so I told them, and they went kind of whispered to each other. And they said, do you think you could write a book to go with it? And I said, yeah. And they said, right, you've got a book deal. And it took like 20.
There'll be people throwing laptops out the window here in this, David.
I know, it's disgusting, isn't it? I often, I wear a stab vest normally when I tell this story because, people hate me. But it's true. I did.
No.
I wrote the book and I had to I only had like 9 weeks to write it.
Gee whiz.
So I was basically making the program during the day and writing the book at night. And I nearly went mad. And I did it and I delivered it. And the publisher said, oh, it's not long enough. So I don't know. I don't know how long is a book. I don't know. No one told me. And they said, no, it was in the contract. All right. Well, I never saw it. So I basically, to fill out, so they said, right, well, if you can put 20,000 words on it, we'll see what we can do tomorrow. So I basically put all the stuff that I'd sidelined back in. All the people arguing, all the people kind of contradicting each other, all the people saying, oh, he wasn't there. Oh, no, he definitely was there. No, I can guarantee you that he wasn't there. All this argumentative stuff, I put it back in, which journalistically you wouldn't normally do. And that is, if I hadn't done that, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation now, because that's what made the book.
Okay.
And there you go. So what I learned was, there's gold there and you maybe don't necessarily realize it. And the gold was the contradictions of people disagreeing with what they saw, what they remember, and swearing blind that they saw this. When 20 other people say the opposite, that's where the gold was, in the kind of contradiction. And I've seen I'm not claiming to have created another genre, but there's so many books like that now of that kind of oral style of people kind of disagreeing with each other and this, that, and the other, particularly in music books. And I Swear I Was There was one of the very, very first. And it works really well because it's quite funny as well.
Yeah, yeah. I guess Please Kill Me, that one about punk. That does it, doesn't it?
And there's loads now. I mean, my bookshelves here are full of music books. Music books are my thing.
Yeah.
And there's certainly loads of them now. But in 2001, this was quite a weird thing to do. And look out for the gold. That's the top tip.
Nice one. Well, look, sir, we're going to move swiftly along into three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. You very kindly have stuck to British-only films, which is...
Yeah, because I've naively thought, given the name of it...
One time that would have been true. I used to do five great British horror films and this has been born out of that format. And I just found I didn't want to talk about Don't Look Now, Blood and Satan's Claw and Wicker Man another time. You know,
yeah, fair enough.
So I was interviewing people from around the world, and so the British part of it just became the name of the show. But I'm very grateful. So
my first choice is The Wicker Man. There you go.
You can piss off. But so just for the people that haven't heard this format before, I'll just run through the rules and obviously remind you what we're going to do. So David has very kindly given me three films that we're going to talk to. We're going to do it for 5 minutes at a time. When the alarm goes, which will sound something like this, and hopefully you can hear this at your end.
Yeah, subtle.
DEFCON 1, it is. So when that goes off, that's our time to stop. I mean, it's basically my inability to politely say, can we stop? Because 5 minutes are up. We can overrun. There's no harm in sort of finishing a thought. Or even starting a thought if it bleeds into that. So is that okay with you, David?
Yeah, grand.
Brilliant. Well, look, let's start with the first on your list. It is Hell is a City from 1960. What made you choose that one?
When I got chucked out of school when I was 16, and I, because I'm really lucky, got a job as a trainee journalist the week after. And it's true, it's ridiculous. And one of my first jobs on this magazine was to clear out a cupboard full of old editions going back to the late 40s. And I'd save one copy, put it in an envelope, chuck the rest away. And I was doing this, and you're flicking through, and I saw one of them had this set of photographs of a film being made in Manchester. And it had pictures of a guy running across the rooftops of what we used to call the Refuge Building. And all of these kind of secretaries with bouffant hair and kind of, you know, greaser boys, messenger boys, leaning out the windows, looking at this filming taking place. And I thought, it looked so cool. And the guy running, I recognize him because he was in that film that my dad likes, Zulu.
That's right, yeah.
And I thought, oh, God, he looks so cool in his white shirt running across the rooftops. That's such a cool image. And then didn't think anything more about it. And then years later, I realized that they were filming Hell is a City. And it wasn't until a long time after I actually got to see the film. And I love it. And, you know, unsurprisingly, what we've just been talking about, it's set in the center of Manchester. In the hills above and around Oldham.
Yeah.
So I might style myself as the king of Manc Noir, but actually the supreme ruler of Manc Noir is Stanley Baker in Hell is a City. It's great. It's got bad guys. It's got tough cops. It's got great locations, many of which you can see, you know, around Manchester still. Some of them are still there. It's got this kind of, this Oldham, this weird kind of, you know, warlike, wartime looking streets of Oldham. It's got the lot, you know, and Stanley Baker, it annoys me when people think of Stanley Baker in terms of Zulu. Mm. You know, I mean, this is a guy who makes... this will be a niche reference for your American listeners. This is a guy who makes Sean Connery look like John Inman. You know what I mean? You know, he just like a slab of man. They used to call him Manly Stanley. He was a Renaissance man. You know, he was a producer and he was an actor. He was putting money back into his community in Wales. He was a fascinating man, and died in the very early 70s of cancer. And one of, Hell Drivers is another one of his films, which is another of that, of very much of the same ilk as Hell is a City. But it's, it's wham bang. It's a great, set piece sequence on the rooftops of Manchester at the end. There's I really like films that have got like almost like a self-contained little film inside of it. And there's this great sequence where the bad guy is attacking a girl who can't speak, and she can't scream, and he's attacking her in this furniture store. And it's a great little self-contained scene, almost like a short film in itself. Donald Pleasance is in it. Billy Whitelaw is in it. Doris Speed, who was in Coronation Street, who played Annie Walker in Coronation Street. There's another niche reference.
I mean, it's also surprising to me when I watched it. I only watched it a couple of years ago myself for the first time. It's surprisingly grim. Like, he's the tortured man who realizes he can't have it all.
Yeah, and there's two endings actually. If you get the DVD of it, there's the alternative ending.
I've not seen the alternative. I've got the Blu-ray.
Yeah, it is the alternative ending, which is more upbeat.
Oh, really?
And but the ending that they kept is this basically the man alone.
Yeah,
walking through Piccadilly Gardens.
Yeah, it's amazingly
very
powerful
downbeat
ending.
And it's violent. It's very sexual as well. It's a sexual film for, Hammer, obviously no strangers to mixing, sex and violence. So it's just a cracking watch. And it's great to see Manchester, shot in this kind of sexy black and white way. It's great to see the hills above Oldham in shot in this kind of like it's a different world from the
central Manchester. that whole sequence where they're gambling and somebody's keeping watch and that, you kind of go, hold on a minute. I thought when we were given all the Brexit lies that there was this sort of beautiful past that we were trying to get back to. What, we're trying to get back to? We're trying to get back to that.
And it always gets a snigger. I saw it in a cinema quite recently, actually, and it always gets a snigger because the gambling dens are referred to as tossing schools. And the gamblers are referred to as tossers. So because there's this weird thing that they're betting on. But yeah, it's if you haven't seen it, it's shown about every 45 minutes on Talking Pictures.
Talking Pictures, yeah.
So get stuck in.
Tossing game they're playing is, have you seen the film Waking Fright, the Australian film?
Oh, right, okay.
With Donald Pleasance in as well from 1973. That's the centre of the story. They play this game in the back of a pub and the protagonist is sort of descends into his own personal toxic masculine hell.
Well, there you go. There's Donald Pleasance, king of the tossing. There's a subgenre right there. The tossing film.
Have we just invented it right now?
Yeah, we're the kings of it.
Well, look, jumping forward two decades to a very different film, no less quintessentially British in what it was doing at the time, is The Great Rock and Roll Swindle.
So, Great Rock and Roll Swindle. It always baffles me where there's been a fashion of late. And when I say, because I'm old, of late means within the last 20 years, of The Filth and the Fury, which is the Julian Temple's film about the Sex Pistols, is a great work. And then to slightly poo-poo The Great Rock and Roll Swindle as a not great work. And I think that's bonkers. Comparing the two is like comparing oranges with Volkswagens. Filth and the Fury is a documentary about the Sex Pistols. And that's it. That's what it is. All it is. Great Rock and Roll Swindle is part comedy, part musical, part cartoon, part 1970s smut film, part music documentary. Is this phantasmagorical beast of every kind of genre you can think of? And I think it's just magic. It's magic. And I love watching it. I watched it with my daughter not so long ago because, I wanted to say, just let's watch this. It's mad. and it's mad. And I think it's great. And so for people to kind of do it down as like, oh, it's not, because it's Malcolm McLaren's vision rather than the vision of the Pistols or whatever, is a terrible shame. And it shows you as well what an amazing filmmaker Julian Temple is, that he could basically take the same story and same materials and tell it in two completely different ways. And I think that shows the measure of the guy. It really does. So, yeah, I will have not have anything said. There's no point in comparing it to Filth and the Fury because it's completely... It's completely different genre and everything. It's got Irene Handel in it. You know, it's got Mary Millington in it.
Yes,
you
it
know,
has,
it's
yeah.
got,
Jesus.
You know, it's just this, it's got cartoons in it. It's got real stuff. It's got fake
Would you
stuff.
Know, I mean, thinking about like just being that, because I was only five by the end of 76. So punk never happened in my mind. So I heard Friggin' the Riggin' because it was swearing in it as my first Sex Pistols song, in my memory of hearing of the Sex Pistols, you know, being at your older cousin's house, you know, and this is the one we're swearing in, and you sort of, so that's, you know, that's in, that's part of this part of the story of the Sex Pistols. I mean, I get the idea that Johnny Lydon isn't part of this story anymore, and we're kind of, it's like the tree falling down, we're getting the documentary of, aren't we, really, rather than the tree stood up proud. But that doesn't make it any less brilliant.
But it's not a documentary. It isn't a documentary.
No, sorry, yes, yeah. It's
musical, it's, cartoon, smutty, comedy.
Sorry, what I meant like as a social document of the time, okay. You know.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's definitely a social document. And I think it's a laugh. And I have to say, you know, that I have ripped it off on many, many occasions. I did a documentary about the Smiths in the early 2000s called These Things Take Time. And it was during that time when Morrissey wouldn't do interviews. My God, I missed that time when Morrissey didn't do interviews. And they said, right, how are you going to get around this? So I thought, what would Julian Temple do? I don't know. He'd make cartoons of it. So I made a cartoon Morrissey and a cartoon Smiths to fill in the bits that I didn't have, which I, you know, an idea I took from Rock and Roll Swindle. And I still have, in a frame in the house, a letter from Morrissey's solicitors shooting some legal shots across my bowels for doing
really?
This. Because Morrissey did not like it at all. So, you know, there's so much going on in Great Rock and Roll Swindle that it's an endless mine of ideas.
Did you get to
if
see...
You're short of an idea, pinch it from Rock and Roll Swindle.
Did you see this then in the cinema when it came out, as it were?
Yeah, I remember seeing it in my favourite cinema of all time, which is the Scala Cinema in London.
Oh, wow.
Where I used to live. I used to live in the Scala Cinema. And I remember seeing it there, probably just shortly after it came out, maybe like a repertory run. And, yeah, what an amazing place the Scala was. You know, they had a cat inside the cinema which would jump up on your lap during the 7-hour Dario Argento marathon you would sit through. And everyone was smoking weed and drinking beer. Amazing.
I'm very jealous of you. I mean, when I came to London in 99, the Scala was already a music venue. It was no longer a place for film.
Yeah, it's an amazing place, amazing place.
I interviewed, I've had Jane Giles has been on, who's written the book about the history of the Scala. She used to program it probably in the 80s and 90s. It's one of them places that I remember used to see it in the music press advertised when I lived in Manchester, and I'd be like, what's this place? Where, how can they get to see all that stuff?
Yeah. We did have one. Again, I'm showing my age now, but there was a cinema called The Arbon in Hume, which basically did the same function. Hardly anybody remembers it, but I can remember going there, and you'd see triple bills of Val Lewton films on a Sunday afternoon. You know, amazing.
Well, so, I mean, you see, going back to what you're saying about how Manchester is depicted, growing up in Radcliffe and Prestwich, you know, because we're north of Victoria Station, we never saw City Limits. You know, that never sold north and Victoria Station. So you were outside of the kind of pop culture side of whatever Manchester was. It was only when you got the train and you discovered, oh my goodness, there's this place that's on my doorstep. I had no idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
So 1972's Tale from the Crypt.
Yeah, it's a portmanteau, an anthology.
Indeed, it is
film. And one thing that's always annoyed me about anthology films is they always feel the need to put a funny one in, a light one, a bit of light relief. You know, most famously, Dead of Night, which has got the awful, awful golfing sequence in, which is horrible and not funny. And I think the American prints took it out. So there's even, you know, even in Ghost Story, there was that kind of funny one with the lad in the forest and things like that. So it's always bugged me that. Tales from the Crypt is unremittingly in-your-face unpleasantness. Bang, 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 bang. Oh, there's a demented Father Christmas trying to strangle Joan Collins. There's a guy with who's going to have the rest of his eternity with embalming fluid burning into his veins.
Oh, it's a great story.
There's a man who has to die over and over and over again. Ian Hendry, having left his wife for his fancy woman. Oh, the guy has to make a choice between being eaten by a giant dog or running through a corridor full of razor blades. It's just so unremittingly unpleasant. Every single story is kind of in your face nastiness. And I think that's what it should be. You know, never mind a flipping, amusing one to clean the palate to ready you for the rest of the film. You know, bollocks to that. Bang, 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 in your face, unpleasantness over and over again. And I can remember my dad worked very hard and he would often fall asleep of an evening. So I got to watch loads of things that I probably shouldn't have done when I was quite young. I can remember him, waking up during Get Carter when Britt Eklund was giving herself one and being packed off the bed fairly sharpish. So this was one of these films that I saw very early on, way before I should have done, and it frightened me to death, particularly the Ian Hendry sequence where he's caught in a never-ending loop. And that really frightened me, that. Ian Hendry, there's another one. There's another actor who, absolutely cracking screen presence of... a man's man, but clearly someone who was incredibly damaged inside, in all the parts that he played. And this is one of them. And it's a cracking little sequence with him, and it's a cracking film, and it's bang, bang, bang in your face, nastiness. And that's what it should be. Never mind these light episodes. Screw that.
Well, I mean, I'm the poster artwork of the skull with the one eyeball was very prominent in my local video shop. Like in the early 80s, so kind of long before I saw the film itself, I was already haunted by judging a book by its cover. I mean, that's half of the fun with horror. Is like what world is behind that image?
When people say, "Oh, you should never judge a book by its cover," no, you should always judge a book by its cover. That's what it's there for. And it's funny. It's the same with those photographs of Stanley Baker that I saw those way before I saw the film. So that sticking in your mind probably way before you saw it.
Absolutely.
The power of a still image is incredibly powerful. And it's a cracking film. There was a fashion at the time for these kind of portmanteau anthology films, particularly from Amicus. Vault of Horror is the kind of companion.
Yeah, and From Beyond the Grave is the...
And the cracking, and the if it comes on, one of those Amicus films from the early 70s comes on late at night, I'm not going to bed. I'm stopping right where I am and I'm going to watch it. Because
Tales from the Crypt is like Vault of Horror, isn't it? It brings together some people and then it's like we get their stories.
Yeah. And what a cast. What a cast. Ralph Richardson, Joan Collins, just Ian Hendry. What fantastic casts. And that's what, again, people forget about. Same with Rock and Roll Swindle. Amazing cast of people, sometimes only doing little bibs and bobs, but proper acting talent being brought to play. And then it's no coincidence that these are great films because they've got proper actors in and doing proper acting. And it's funny that, isn't it? The better the actors, the better the film.
Is there a scene or a sequence that sort of lives up, that stands out the most for you in terms of...
100%. I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but now I'm going to spoil it, obviously.
I think we can a 72 film.
Ian Hendry has left his wife for his fancy woman, as we used to say in the 70s, and they involved in a car crash, and he gets out of the wreckage and is staggered around, and people are freaking out when they see him and things like that. And he finally goes to his girlfriend's house, and she's blind, and she wants to know where he's been for the last year. And he can't work, and he's baffled as to what's going on. And then he looks down, he sees himself in a reflection, and his face is absolutely fucked up, you know, absolutely. And it's just for a moment where he sees himself, and then bang, he's back in the car again. And it's just that flash image of him seeing his face absolutely freaked me out. Absolutely freaked me out. And there's loads of them, though. You know, Joan Collins being strangled by Father Christmas.
Yeah, that's
amazing. You know, there's an image. The razor blades in the car.
The embalming fluid one is really powerful, because that's a very monkey's paw type thing, isn't it? That idea of give what you wish for kind of thing.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's real. It's strong stuff. It's strong soup.
I'd forgotten that's the one that doesn't give you a light, doesn't soft soap you at some point, just to
it's just pure unadulterated unpleasantness.
Indeed.
And I'm all for it.
Indeed. Well, look, we've come to the end of your three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. I'm sure we could talk for more. I'm pretty certain of that for fans. I'll remind people then, obviously, we were talking originally about your Manc Noir trilogy, Black Moss, Mermaid's Pool, and most recently, The Ballad of Hanging Lees, which I've read two out of three, and there's a visceral authenticity to it that I really loved. And being from the area, it kind of is, it's like a dark revisiting of home, which is, I guess a compliment like given the subject
matter.
That
sounds like a Thor song, doesn't it?
So it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving your time on BritFlix podcast.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.